Hello, everybody. I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, or most frustrating experience in the archives.
And once again, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today, we are delighted to be speaking to Dr. Mike Jones, an archivist and historian based at the Australian National University. After over a decade working in museums and archives, Mike completed a PhD in history at the University of Melbourne. He's the author of the 2021 book, Artifacts, Archives and Documentation in the Relational Museum, and is currently Deputy Director of the ANU's Research Centre for Deep History. In short, Mike is a historian who writes about archives and hence pretty much the ultimate guest for Archive Fever. We first planned to speak to Mike back in 2020 in season two, but COVID has kept us separated until now. But we're very happy that today Mike is in the studio with us at La Trobe's Bundoora campus on unceded Wurundjeri land. Mike, welcome to Archive Fever.
Thanks for having me.
Mike, you obviously have a pretty long-standing interest in archives and archiving. How did this all begin? When were you first bitten by the research bug?
It's got a bit of a long history to it. I started out as an art history student primarily at University of Melbourne, did my honours there. I went to University of Edinburgh and did a master's in art history. I'd been engaged in kind of research, working with archives, working with materials, that sort of stage. Then I came back from Edinburgh, flat broke, needed a job, went and worked for a bank for about 5 years, 6 years. Wasn't very satisfied with the banking sector, thought this culture doesn't really suit me. I need to find something different to do. A friend of mine was working at the University of Melbourne at that stage in a research centre, and she thought, well, this job seems like the sort of job that Mike might enjoy. And so invited me along to do some casual work 3 days a week with her. And my first day on that job was walking into the State Library of Victoria while it was still closed, completely deserted, walking through the main reading rooms to this room at the back that was filled with archive boxes, and started to work on archival collections as a trainee archivist, essentially. And even on the first day of that job, walking through those spaces and re-engaging with these sort of research spaces and that material, I thought, yeah, this is something I could do for a while. So I did that work for a few months and then really engaged with that research centre and its work, stepped up to 4 days a week, stepped up to 5 days a week, got a continuing position, started leading projects. But it was really that kind of moment of starting to work on those collections in this room at the back of the State Library of Victoria that engaged me with archives again and reconnected me with that kind of research space.
That sounds a bit like a moment of archive fever.
A little bit like
And what was it about that moment that engaged you so much that made you feel like this was the work you wanted to be doing?
I think it was having been away from those kind of spaces for so long and working in a sector and a corporate kind of environment that I didn't feel any intellectual connection with, any kind of emotional connection with. I'd always been a really avid reader. I'd been interested in history. I'd been interested in documentaries. I'd been interested in intellectual and cultural side of life. And that had been missing from my life for a number of years. So I think it was that reconnection with what had essentially been a kind of lifelong passion in a way. And I'd stepped out of it and hadn't really realized how much I missed it until I walked back into those kind of spaces.
And it sounds like you got to be trained as an archivist sort of essentially on the job. What did that training actually look like? Like, how does one learn sort of the skills of an archivist?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because these days most archivists go through university courses. There's a requirement in a lot of cases or for a lot of jobs to have a degree. On-the-job training is increasingly rare or has been in recent decades for archivists and archives. My first kind of days on the job involved really basic things like there was a collection that contained hundreds and hundreds of pages of newspaper clippings, and we were refoldering those out of standard manila folders into acid-free folders. untangling these cut up newspaper clippings and trying to get them back into these acid-free folders so that they could be preserved. Things like taking staples out of documents. If you want to be put off using a stapler for the rest of your life, then work in archives for a while because you'll spend days just removing staples from documents. But as I was doing that, the archivists that I was working with were talking to me about how this collection was structured, about how they were creating a finding aid for this, how they were documenting this collection, who had created those collections. We started to do research into the provenance of these collections, so who had been the people who had created and used these collections before they came to the library. So through those conversations, it started out as kind of informal training, and then I started helping to write those finding aids, and you start learning about archival structure, you start learning about concepts like provenance, you start learning about the Australian series system, which is a kind of local or Australian-based system for describing archives and archival collections. And that then turns into theoretical discussions about, well, what is a series and how do these structures reflect the sort of knowledge in these collections? And so it was through being gradually introduced to those different levels of archival work that I gradually became more immersed in the theoretical side of this, the intellectual history. And then we started to write articles about the projects that we'd been doing, and that led to engaging with archival literature and archival theory, and then looking at the way that other people have written about archives. So as a, you know, a really kind of gentle introduction through what might seem quite kind of mundane tasks, but that led into this whole world of theoretical and practical investigation of how archives work and how they're structured.
Mike, one of the things that that investigation has led you to is to be quite critical of the ways in which historians tend to fetishize archives and the space of archives, the experience of going to the archives, the buildings that archives are held in, and the archives themselves as objects. And you've written about the ways that many historians who you point to, Tom Griffiths, Greg Denning, people that we've all kind of grown up worshipping in a way, that they have used very religious sort of symbolism to describe their experience in archives. Can you explain some of that to us, the ways in which you found this pattern, this tendency to sort of sacralize the archive?
Yeah, absolutely. I think walking up to a lot of large library buildings and archives buildings, you can see this kind of physically imposing presence. So I don't think there's in some ways a kind of surprise that those connections have been made. You walk up to the front of the State Library of Victoria and it looks like a temple. It's columns with the portico over the top. You look at the National Library in Canberra, a more recent example, but that in itself is a modern take on a temple design with the columns all around the outside. And you walk into things like the reading room of the State Library of Victoria and it's a cathedral-like space and people describe it in these terms. But I think a lot of the times those descriptions create a barrier to understanding what archives actually are and how they work. And the particularities of archives and the way that the materials in archives can help us understand different things about the past, but also have gaps in them, can be used for very different purposes, not just for history, and have really practical relevance to people and their lives in ways that historians don't necessarily discuss as part of their work. Mm. I think what brought all this together for me in a way is, well, a couple of aspects. Firstly, it's having worked in that kind of practical and sometimes very mundane and the boring practicalities of how to prepare this material. But there's an enormous amount of intellectual work and decision-making that happens with archivists working with this material that really shapes and structures these collections. These aren't raw materials that are sitting there waiting to be kind of uncovered and revealed by historians or other researchers coming into these spaces. They're already very much shaped by culture, by intellectual decisions, and by these theoretical decisions that happen. But also, I did a lot of work increasingly with groups like Forgotten Australians and former child migrants, people who were in orphanages and children's homes as children, who were then looking for records about their life and their experience. Working with communities like that, even the physical spaces of these buildings are imposing and daunting and intimidating, and yet these institutions can hold files that tell people, for example, who their parents are or whether they have brothers and sisters or explain something about what happened to them as children. they walk into these sorts of spaces and they don't see a church or a religious space, or if they do, they find that incredibly confronting and incredibly intimidating. It creates a real barrier to entry to these spaces for people who really need to access those sorts of materials. I think for those sorts of communities, and for the community more broadly who feels uncomfortable in these kind of daunting, imposing spaces, there's a lot more work that could be done to make people understand that these are actually accessible to all sorts of people in the community. There's all sorts of valuable records in archives. There's interesting curiosities in archives, and they're not sacred spaces that only the initiated can enter and that you need a degree to understand the content of. They're actually democratic spaces. They're inclusive spaces. And I think that should be encouraged rather than treated with a kind of reverence.
Indeed, one of the problems that you identify in using this kind of religious metaphor of the uncovering, the digging, the transmogrification of an archive into writing is that it does set up the historian as the priest, the high priest of this archival sacred space. And so that there is not a sense of that democratic. I mean, we saw that, you know, the Reformation undid the whole Catholic Church because of that idea of the priest being the only one who could have direct contact with God. So do you think historians have been implicated in that very anti-democratic, very elitist, almost papal relationship to archives?
I think in some cases, yes, and I don't think that's the intention of historians writing in that way. I think it's in some ways a kind of unthinking consequence of using that language. And it's difficult because as historians and as people who work in archives, we are passionate about these spaces. They can be, to use a semi-religious word, they can be revelatory experiences. You're going into spaces and going through materials that in some cases people haven't looked at for a long time. Keeping in mind that archivists and others have looked at that material before, it's there. You know, it's not discovering something like an archaeologist digging a potsherd out of the ground. But these are spaces where we do have quite intense experiences sometimes of discovery and can develop a real passion for those spaces. Yes, so I think given all that, historians are implicated in setting up that kind of model. It's through a lack of awareness and in some cases probably a lack of care about the language that's used. And it's unthinkingly repeating the language of previous generations of historians. Something that I talk about in my article on the Temple of History is this language that goes back to Michelet. It goes back to these ideas of the historian resurrecting dead scraps of history and dead scraps of material, as though the archive is a dead space until a historian comes along, and it's only the historian who can animate those kind of dead scraps of material. And that kind of language has been repeated all the way through. You can see it repeated in articles from the past 5 years with historians continuing to write in the same way. I think there's a lack of kind of awareness about the potential implications of that language, which is also why I say it's not necessarily an intentional thing. But what I was trying to do in really highlighting the frequency of some of those kind of uses of language and those terms is to just make historians think a bit more consciously about how they talk about those kind of spaces.
I wonder, though, do you think the kind of motivation to use this language that, you know, reifies the historian as priest in the archive, could that also partially come from a kind of anxiety about the kind of professional standing of historians, particularly, you know, at the moment in Australia and many Western countries where humanities are seen as under threat from funding cuts and so on? Do you think there's a kind of, I don't know, professional kind of boundary work going on in historians claiming their own authority and expertise in archives to the exclusion of all others?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. It's not just historians that do this. So archivists do the same thing from the archival side. Having worked with archivists and going to archives conferences and things for many years, archivists patrol the boundaries of what the term archive means and will, in some cases, again, a generalization, but some archivists will get quite up in arms about the fact that you go into your Gmail account and you drop down a menu and says archive, and they say, that's not archiving. Of course that's not archiving. How can you use that term for that? Or again, historians or other academics writing a funding application and they say, I'm going to produce a digital archive of this, or I'm going to put this material on a website and it's called the archive of this type of history. a lot of archivists will look at that and say, well, that's not an archive. You're not engaging with archival science. You're not structuring things based on the original order of the records. You're not considering provenance in the proper way. How are you actually going to preserve this for the next 100 years? That's not an archive. There's that patrolling of these disciplinary boundaries in the same way in the archival space. So I can see the kind of impetus for historians doing the same sort of thing and for any kind of profession or any discipline. However, I think the value of historians in the archival space is not that historians are the only ones who can do that kind of work. I'm really interested in the relational kind of structures between things and the way things interrelate. And I think disciplines should say we're a really vital part of this network of relationships that exists that helps to generate meaning and understanding about the past. Archivists are part of that network as well. Communities and community members are part of that network. And we need to be working through all of those relationships effectively. Historians need to be there as part of that network rather than standing at the boundaries of the discipline and saying, stay out of here, this is our space. I think it needs to be standing at the boundaries of the discipline and saying, look at how effectively we connect with all these other spaces and how we can create this kind of network of meaning and historical knowledge production. That's why historians are valuable, I think, not because we're in a walled-off city and can do something that no one else can do.
Mike, I'm really keen to know what you think of our little podcast in that we have eschewed a religious metaphor for understanding our relationship to archives and the research process, but we've taken on more of a disease metaphor. Jacques Derrida's idea of archive fever, and we talk about it as an obsession, and when did you get your first hit, and we describe our setup here as Archives Anonymous. Do you think that this is helpful in expanding the notion of who does research, how they do it, why they do it, so the whole kind of idea of methodology, and also the fact that we've broadened the idea of the archive to talk to people who see country as archive and journalists who make other podcasts. So we've tried to be expansive and inclusive, but do you think that our disease model has its own inbuilt problems?
I don't see it immediately as problematic as the kind of sacred religious metaphor. It doesn't feel like it's a kind of metaphor that's exclusionary in a way. I mean, you know, describing it as a kind of addiction to something like an addiction to chocolate or, you know, something where you need a hit from something is kind of, in a way, provided it's not going too far down the disease path, is probably, you know, something where you can say to a broader group of people, we want you to get the same kind of sugar hit from this experience that we get from this, and is trying to hopefully democratize that sort of hit rather than pathologize that hit. I don't know, I mean, to what extent do you see it as a pathological kind of desire for the archives rather than a kind of just a desire for that hit?
Well, I do wonder, though, that the language we use on this podcast does kind of fetishize archives still and reinforce this idea that they are particularly kind of meaningful and transformational spaces, which I think is perhaps kind of akin to the sort of sacred language you've critiqued in your article, Mike. Certainly reading your work made me reflect kind
yeah,
of much
that's,
more
that's
critically
why I
in, yeah,
in thought
how
about
we talk Kristen about archives
Chu, yes, absolutely.
In this space. Like we kind of take for granted that they are really, you know, almost mystical spaces. And we don't interrogate that. We don't kind of interrogate the idea that they could actually be really banal, kind of everyday dull spaces, which I think all of us who have used archives know they can be sometimes. You know, sometimes you're just tired and hungry and you're not finding anything interesting and it's dusty and you just kind of want to be anywhere else.
But it also occurs to me, and I'm interested in your thought on this, Mike, is that we sacralize a lot of spaces. Like we talk about a pilgrimage to the MCG, and we often talk about sporting venues as being holy, sacred spaces as well. Is it actually something to do with our need in a secular world to find a kind of religious affiliation, some sense of the spiritual, and where we go as nerdy historians is to libraries and archives, but where other people go is to sporting grounds or beaches or
in recent history, the Anzac Day tradition. Mm. I've seen the latest sort of descriptions from politicians is Anzac Day is the most sacred day of the year. Mm. It's the most sacred day in the Australian calendar. I think there is a tendency to do that. In all of those cases, though, that language is setting up a connection for certain groups of people or for certain parts of a society and is privileging people who have that sort of connection in some ways over people who don't have that sort of connection. And I think, at least to my mind, there are areas of society where that's potentially less problematic than others. And also, sometimes when this happens on a one-to-one basis, it's a kind of, you know, a passing reverie. It's a little kind of metaphor that people use. It's a kind of off-the-cuff comment. And the problem isn't with the individual nature of those comments when they happen. It's the cumulative effect of those over long periods of time that creates this kind of mystique around these sorts of spaces that I think is more problematic. And I think in terms of exploring that, and I can speak more authoritatively about the archive space than, say, the sporting space, but is to think about the people that that excludes and to think about the people that that marginalizes and the people that that puts off from those spaces. You know, if Anzac Day is seen as the most sacred day of the year, then what does that mean in an Australian context for, say, Turkish immigrants in Australia who have relatives who are on the other side of some of those conflicts? This sort of idea of sacred spaces makes those spaces safe for particular sorts of people in a community or in a society. And yet you speak with, I have Indigenous colleagues, Kirsten Thorpe is one who has written quite extensively about the idea of cultural safety in collecting institutions and places like state libraries and archives. And as an Indigenous woman working in those spaces feels unsafe in those spaces, even as someone who works in those spaces and has worked in those spaces for many, many years. As I said, people who feel like these institutions have information about their lives that they should have, but is being protected in these kind of sanctuaries, and you have to go through all these protocols to access these sort of spaces. And the archivists who work in these spaces, and potentially historians and others, have seen information about these people's lives that they don't know themselves, and describe that then as a temple. And they say, well, can I come into your temple? And you say, well, actually, you need to make an appointment in advance, and you need to have checked our finding aid online, and then you need to come and meet this person at a door at a particular time, and then they'll swipe you through, and you need to go into this reading room, but you can't bring a pen with you, and you've got to put your bag in this locker over here. And you know, it creates these administrative structures around it, as well as these metaphorical structures, that is a real barrier to access and a real turnoff, essentially, to people to be able to get that sort of hit. You know, being able to get that hit, to go back to those kind of metaphors, comes with a whole bunch of privilege, a privilege of time, a privilege of money, a privilege of access, and a kind of cultural privilege to feel comfortable in those spaces. And a lot of people don't.
And so what would it look like to make archives and museums culturally safe for a broader group of people? And are institutions kind of already taking steps in that direction?
Institutions are taking steps in those sort of directions, and it's a long and slow process. Yeah. Even just a physical space point of view, it's difficult to do something in the short term in a lot of cases about the imposing nature of the buildings themselves. But there are some very sort of practical steps in those spaces that you can use of making arrangements with people to go and meet them at the front door of the institution rather than expect them to walk through those spaces on their own and have to navigate through those administrative protocols themselves. There's increasing work around giving people support in archival spaces about the sort of material that they might encounter, particularly when they're doing research about themselves and their own lives, and training archivists on how to deal with the fact that working in archives for some researchers and some people can be a quite traumatizing experience or a kind of overwhelming experience. I think there's also opportunities to take that material out of some of those spaces and take material to communities. Rather than expect people to have to come into those spaces and go through those protocols themselves. There's been work with Indigenous communities, with care leaver communities and Forgotten Australians communities of, you know, going to things like community open days and setting up photo boards and showing people material and getting people to go through and say, oh, I know who that person is and I know who that person is. And then documenting those names and using those to improve things like archival documentation and search for other users, so that people feel not just connected to the material, but actually become part of the process of documenting that material and feel like their knowledge is valuable and their knowledge becomes part of those kind of collections. But it's allowing people also to describe that material themselves, to contribute their own comments that can become part of the archive. In some cases, it's allowing people to, and this is perhaps a more confrontational idea for a lot of people, including historians, the idea of allowing people to take records from archives to potentially destroy records about themselves because they have the right over the information that's about them. There are people that I've worked with who say that the thing that they want the most is be able to take their records out of the archives about what happened to them in children's homes, and they want to read them themselves, process that material, and then destroy them because they don't want their family to be able to read them, let alone other people in the community, let alone researchers or archivists or people who worked in those institutional spaces. They say, those are my records and I don't want that information out there about what happened to me in those institutions. That's my story. So allowing people to control their story rather than saying we control your story and we can control who accesses it and under what circumstances they can access those materials, that's a real power dynamic shift and is something that archives and museums and other kind of collecting spaces are continuing to struggle with.
And it's an interesting one because you're really highlighting the power dynamic in archives that are created because they have been collected by institutions or their institutional collections that have then gone into become an archive through the process of time and legislation often as well, as opposed to archives that have been created by, say, somebody has donated their own materials to the archive, thinking of people like Manning Clark or Helen Garner, who we've had on the show. And those people are then able to put their own stipulations about how their archive is used by others afterwards.
Yep.
So there's a power imbalance there that's based on class. Sometimes it might be based on gender as well. Do you think that people should be able to put limits on how their own archive are used, or if you donate an archive, should that then be open slather?
No, I think people certainly should be able to put limits on that. However, again, that's a really complex space in a lot of ways. You know, thinking about something like the Germaine Greer archive that went into the University of Melbourne archives, one of the really interesting parts of that collection is all the letters that Germaine Greer has written by women all over the world, and she kept every single one of those. You know, all that material goes into the collection. Are those women expecting those letters to then be made available to researchers under the conditions that Germaine Greer sets on that collection, rather than them having control over their own material, which is where that gets really complex. And they're the sort of complexities that can actually never be resolved. But yes, I think absolutely people should have some level of control over their own records. People should be able to say, I don't want this part of this archive released until, for example, after my death or after a certain number of years, because there's incredibly personal information in these collections, and I think that needs to be respected and protected. I'm not a kind of open access person. I think there are a lot of conditions under which open access becomes really problematic and access needs to be controlled. One of the other aspects of this is that there are obligations on researchers and users of collections to treat this material with a level of respect.
But not reverence.
Not reverence, no, not reverence. But there's an ethical obligation here of, particularly with personal collections, one of the most valuable thing about archival collections, as we know, as people who work with them, with personal collections in particular, is that this is material that was never designed to be made public. Mm. It's not produced with the idea that this becomes publicly accessible. You're looking at people's private diaries. You're looking at private correspondence. Some people really carefully shape the archive that goes into a collection. But some people die suddenly mid-career and their family makes all these decisions about what goes in there. And the person who wrote those papers has no say over what goes in there. They're not involved in that process. They don't set the access conditions. So it's an insight into those kind of intimate personal documents that weren't designed with the intention of other people reading them. And that comes with obligations as users of that material, as well as obligations for archivists and institutions to deal with that material with sensitivity.
And yeah, the Germaine Greer archive is a really fascinating case study. We actually interviewed Rachel Buchanan, who was one of the archivists who worked on that back in season one, which was a really interesting conversation.
Yeah.
Mike, unfortunately, we're running out of time, so we'll have to start wrapping things up. But before we let you go, we'd like to ask a question we ask all our guests here in Archives Anonymous, which is, do you have a dirty little archive secret you're willing to share with us?
I'm not sure what a dirty little archive secret is, but I guess there are some archives that people would probably assume that I've used and that I've visited and that I haven't. I'm a historian working in Canberra who's worked in the archive sector since 2008, and I've never done archival research at the National Archives of Australia.
Shock, shame.
I've been to many events there. I've organised things with people from the National Archives. I've done all sorts of work there, but I've never actually gone there, requested a file and done work in the National Archives, which I feel like is a gap in my career as both an archivist and a historian. So I might need to do something
about that.
I must confess,
the same for me. I did my PhD in Canberra at ANU and lived there for 4 years and used many institutions in Canberra, but never actually used the reading room at the National Archives in Canberra. I've used the National Archives branch in Sydney, but not the Canberra one. So
Claire looks stunned.
I am. I'm stunned. I've spent many happy, happy weeks of my life at the National Archives of Australia.
I can tell you another secret as well about an archival collection in the State Library of Victoria. And this wasn't me that did this, but it was one of my colleagues. I was talking about the mundane job of taking staples out. And when you take staples out from a collection, you put these little plastic paper clips on the top to replace the staple. And they're coloured little paper clips. And there's a collection that we were working on close to the football grand final in the State Library of Victoria. And the files in there, if you look at the coloured paper clips, they're the team colours of the teams that were playing in the grand final going through the file in those documents. So if anyone's going through documents in the State Library of Victoria, you come across a file with multicoloured clips, check it, because it might be the grand final teams for that year.
I love that. And that's brought together our sporting metaphors and our archival metaphors all in one beautiful little anecdote.
And it's like a timestamp of when that collection was processed.
Yep.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us, Mike. It's been a real treat.
To learn more about Mike's work, you can follow him on Twitter at MikeJonesPhD or visit his academic profile at the Australian National University.
You can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of Seasons 1, 2 and 3 via the website archivefeverpod.com, as well as our bonus episodes from Sydney Writers' Festival and Adelaide Writers' Week. So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees, and you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode.
I think a lot of donor conceived people can relate that our body is an archive in our faces. So you often hear people say that when they find out the truth, you know, late discovery as an adult, and this happened to me as well, it's almost like you don't recognise your own face in the mirror anymore. When I had no other way to search for information, it was just basically looking at my mother and myself and then deducing what my biological father might be like, which actually was quite surprisingly quite accurate. It's a really interesting area of, you know, of science.